Tartan Noir, as the name suggests, refers to Scottish crime fiction, with a particular emphasis on writers who explore the psychology of flawed characters, the duality of good and evil residing in the human soul. The term was originally coined in reference to Ian Rankin, but other writers who fall into the Tartan Noir genre are Val McDermott, a recent guest on this program, Mandy Scott, and Louise Welsh. Louise Welsh's latest novel owes its atmosphere more to the gothic tales of Edgar Allan Poe than the gritty urban thriller. Naming the Bones is set partly in Edinburgh and Glasgow, but its darkest twists occur on a desolate island off the Scottish coast. In the incessant rain, academic Dr. Murray Watson stumbles through windswept crags, abandoned villages and deep lime pits to research an obscure Scottish poet from the 1970s. In the process, he discovers unsettling truths about his subject and himself. It's a tale that could be read as a warning to those with a tendency to obsess. Anita Barrow spoke to Louise Welsh when she was here for the Melbourne Writers Festival about brooding characters, the people and the landscape.
Well, the main protagonist in Naming the Bones is Murray Watson, who's an English literature lecturer, and he's researching into the life of a poet called Archie Lunan. And this really follows his journey. Things in Murray's personal life collapse, and he becomes more and more obsessed with this poet. And I'd like to point out, I did not write any poetry. No poetry was harmed in the making of this book.
And in fact, he had this poet, Archie Lunan, at the age of 16, but he hadn't actually read the poetry. He liked the cover.
Exactly, yes. And I think there's often books within my books, and Murray comes across this poetry collection, a very slim volume, when he's 16, and he just likes the look of it and holds on to it. But when he actually opens the pages and begins to read it, he becomes entranced.
And Murray is a person who really doesn't face up to things very much. He doesn't really commit.
I think that's true, actually. He's very focused on his work, as a lot of academics are, and this makes him a good sort of detective figure in a way. He's got this drive, but in other areas of his life, he's quite willing to go with the flow, and it's only really when he starts to take control that things take off for him.
I get the feeling that he is researching someone else's life so that he doesn't actually have to look at his own too much.
I think that's true, yeah. He becomes estranged from his brother, who's his only remaining member of the family. He falls out a bit with his friends. Things don't work out with his lover. So in a way, this is all that he has.
And he's a bit prudish, despite the illicit love affair with the academic's wife. There's a bit of a prude to him, or is that a sort of Scottish sensibility or something?
I think he's brilliantly hypocritically prudish. There's a moment when he finds out his brother's had an affair, and he's furious, although Murray himself is involved with a married woman. So I'm not sure if it's a particularly Scottish thing. I think it's something that's within all of us. You think, that's awful. Then you think, oh, hang on a minute, I don't have affairs, but sometimes you think, that's awful. And you think, oh, hang on, I've done that.
And the book, I mean, you talk about him and being an academic. It's the book also, I guess, in some ways explores the nature of academia, the nature of research. There's a line which says, the poetry was the thing, the life was an unfortunate distraction from the work. They should delete authors' names from all books and let the works speak for themselves.
I think it's a debate, really, isn't it? Because I'm as fascinated as anybody else in the life of artists, actors, writers. We always imagine people are having much more interesting, exotic lives elsewhere. But on the other hand, of course, the work should be the thing. So I think there's a tension there between the two things. How much does one's life influence the work, and how valid is it for us as a reader to poke around in these recesses of other people's lives? And that's partly what Murray's caught up in. And again, the tension perhaps between art and academia as well. Murray loves this art. He loves poetry. He loves literature. And yet he will never produce any himself. And there's some kind of tension there, I think.
And it's also, I guess, how much you dig into. You know, sometimes you find out more than you perhaps should know.
Well, that's the great thing, isn't it? And it's a, I think, a biographer's decision sometimes as well. How much am I going to reveal, especially if the person's still alive? I think that's a kind of interesting question. If you find out things that perhaps their family wouldn't want to be revealed, or the person themselves wouldn't want to be revealed. And I guess a very cold-hearted biographer will just open the doors and let us see everything that's there.
It's something, it's a theme that you've visited before, I think, you know, that heart, that compulsion to dig. In the cutting room, for example, there's the main character is digging into a story behind some rather very lurid photographs. He finds this nature of curiosity, but then it developing into something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess all of my books, in a way, are some kind of quest, some kind of search, and it's a journey often through a geographical place as well. This particular book takes Murray from the city off to an island called Lismore, and with my first book, The Cutting Room, Rilke had to go across Glasgow. So he's moving geographically, but also within himself, of course, and finding out things about himself.
And in a way, the landscape's another kind of character, a brooding sort of character, this island, Lismore. Can you take us there?
Yes, I wonder if I'll ever be allowed back myself. It's a very beautiful place, a really lovely little island about an hour from Oban on the west coast of Scotland. I wanted somewhere that had an illusion of being remote, because once you're there, it just feels like you and the sea, really. It's not very wide at all. There's less than 100 people live there. There's fantastic wildlife, great bird life, great walking, great cycling, a lot of archaeology, and not much else.
Lime pits,
yeah. There's sinkholes, which are quite clearly marked, but the knowledge that lime pits produce this kind of geological collapse makes you a very wary walker. I don't go much off the paths at certain points.
It's like another, I mean, it gives it that kind of gothic sensibility, I think.
Absolutely, and I think it's something you sometimes recognise in Australian literature as well, this idea of going somewhere else, going out into the bush or the countryside, and that, if you're a city dweller, that being a different place, and because you're beyond your ken, also a place where you begin to feel uncomfortable, and a place no one will hear you scream in the countryside. And I live in the city. I go to the Highlands and Islands a lot, but there's always a point in the middle of the night when I think, what was that noise?
Is that, do you think, the difference between your normal sort of chilling thriller and a gothic thriller? The landscape, that sort of sense of loneness.
It's hard to say, isn't it? Because thrillers and the Gothic pervades so much of literature. But I think definitely a genre of sensation, and this kind of physical sensation that you get when you're on your own, and you think perhaps you're not on your own, is something that you want the reader to feel when you're reading these books, that kind of prickle at the back of the neck. And that makes you go and turn up the lamps and put the radio on and draw the curtains.
Why do you want to do that? I've read that you like to take the reader to uncomfortable places.
I think every writer is first and foremost a reader. And I guess it's the kind of sensation that I like having when I'm reading. And it's part of the power of literature that struck me at a very early age when I was reading people like Robert Louis Stevenson. In Treasure Island, there's a moment when the little boy meets Blind Pugh, and this blind sailor who's really cruel to him. And you think, you just get carried away by it as a child. And I guess that's never quite left me. And so I do want readers to feel something, yes.
It's a sort of a vicarious fear that you...
I guess so, yeah. And hopefully, I think it's a balancing act for writers. You know, how much do you... It has not to be completely gratuitous. And how far are you going to go? How far do you have to go to create that sensation actually sometimes you have to pull back, take out a lot of adjectives and just make it simpler. A simple effect can work very well.
And there's sparsity in that too, then, which also creates that atmosphere when you have sparse. You're often described as a person that's bridging that line between literature and crime fiction.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that kind of, the genre definitions are kind of...
They're blurring these days, aren't they?
I think so, yeah. And I think we talk about genre because, well, to enable us to talk about the work as well, don't we? And so I'm really happy to be put into genres.
I think it's easy, though, when you go to a bookshop and you say, here's crime thrillers.
Exactly,
or
yeah.
Fantastic fiction or literature.
Yeah, and I think writers basically want to be on all the shelves, don't they? We want to be in the crime shelf, the literature shelf. I think it works fine unless we box people in and say, you're writing a crime book, you cannot now write something else. And I think I've been really... pretty lucky not to have been boxed in.
Can you give a reading, some indication of...
Yeah. I noticed Melbourne had a lot of bars, and Glasgow also has a lot of bars. So I thought I might read just a little bit that has some drinking in it.
That sounds fair enough, too.
Fowlers had quenched thirsts for at least 100 years. Its high ceiling was iced with intricate cornicing, its windows frosted with etchings advertising whiskies and beers, which let light filter into the bar, but allowed privacy from passers-by to priests, poets, skivers, fathers on an errand or men seeing about dogs, idle students and lovers budgeting towards leaving their spouses. Mrs. Noon kept things tight, and it was rare to wait too long to be served or to see a fight that got beyond the third punch. Fowler should have been a nice place for a drink, but it was a dump, a prime-time contender for a brewery theme pub revamp. There were no ashtrays on the table, but the ceiling retained its nicotine hue and the smell of unwashed old men, stale beer, and the cheap bleach used to sluice down the toilets was no longer masked by cigarette smoke. The bar stools, which harboured men who remembered the city when it was all soot and horseshit, were as scuffed and unsteady on their pins as their occupants. The orange and blue carpet, once loud enough to drown out the Saturday night crowd, had sunk to sludge. Murray tipped back his fifth pint of the evening and decided this was where he belonged.
What you do for your research, hey?
It's really hard work, that bit. I guess there's a lot of excess in the book as well, and Murray's... tipping into excess, and this means a lot of his boundaries are kind of going down, and it means that he becomes more and more focused on this quest for a poet and goes further perhaps than he should. I guess it's just sex, drugs and poetry, isn't it?
Louise Welsh and her novel Naming the Bones is published by Text. She was talking sex, drugs and poetry with The Book Show's Anita Barrow. On tomorrow's program, the cultural pay gap. In Australia, most artists, including most writers, can't live from their work. Compare this to top international author James Patterson, who rakes in $70 million a year. We discuss the authorial pay gap in Headlines, our regular segment on the latest book news. And we'll hear from Justin Cronin, whose vampire-ish novel, The Passage, turned him into a multimillionaire overnight. That's The Book Show tomorrow on ABC Radio National, tomorrow morning after the news at 10, tomorrow evening after 8. For details of guests and books and audio and selected transcripts, of course, go to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. I'm Peter Mayers, next on ABC Radio National, First Person.